Excellent, thank you. I would like to call to order the Shoreline Planning Commission meeting of Thursday, August 7th. Carla, will you call roll, please?
Yes. Chair Brinson?
Here.
Commissioner Cabe?
Here.
Commissioner Frye?
Here.
Commissioner Hadley? Oh, hold on. There you go. Commissioner Hadley? No?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, perfect. Commissioner Lynn?
Here.
Vice Chair Mosier?
Here.
Commissioner Povich?
Here.
Thank you.
All right, next, approval of the agenda. Anyone? Changes? Good. Next, approval of last meeting's minutes from July 17th. Any changes? Comments? Nope. Good. All right. Public comment. Do we have any tonight?
We have no public comment tonight. Thank you.
Moving right along. Study items. We will now move to the discussion of co-living housing development code amendments. Come on up.
Good evening, commissioners. Elise Keim, planning manager here at the City of Shoreline. And my role today is to introduce Kevin Bagwell, associate planner here at the city, who's been taking the lead on co-living housing. Take it away, Kevin.
Good evening. So, co-living housing. The Washington State Legislature passed House Bill 1998 to require cities to allow co-living housing last year. It applies to fully planning cities like Shoreline, and Shoreline must adopt regulations to comply with the state law, or the state law will preempt the city by December 31st of this year.
Can you
start over?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That is hearing my own voice. So the Washington State Legislature passed House Bill 1998 to require cities to allow co-living housing in 2024. It applies to fully planning cities like the City of Shoreline, and Shoreline has to either comply with the state law, or that state law will preempt the city by December 31st of this year. So tonight's agenda will be going over what is co-living housing, why is it important, what are the state requirements, some discussion items, and a proposed schedule for the adoption to comply with the December 31st deadline. So what is co-living housing? Co-living housing might have many terms that you may know. These terms may be reminiscent of a bygone era around the 20th century. Co-living is where everyone shares a kitchen and a person just rents the room. Rooms may or may not have a private bathroom, and at the end of the day, co-living housing must have that shared kitchen. So, what co-living used to be? Housing used to be for everyone. Clerks, painters, carpenters, cops, and those just arriving to new cities could all find places to stay within their price range. It's estimated that one-third to one-half of all people living in urban areas either boarded or took in boarders at some point in their lives. Flexible and affordable housing was what was abundant in urban areas before larger single-family dwellings became the 1950s American dream. These co-living housing spaces cost what would be the equivalent of about $15 today, and were close to where people would live, eat, and work. So these are pictures of the Arete building. It's 228 co-living units, 52 traditional dwellings, a half mile from Heritage Park along Lake Washington. It costs about $1,099 per month for 170 square feet with a kitchenette and a private bathroom. While the average rent in Kirkland is $2,711, which means a minimum wage worker would need to work approximately 540 hours a month to afford that average rent in Kirkland, but only 220 to afford a room at Arete. And this is pictures of the Carsty building. It's 52 units, 3,000 square feet of common living area, two blocks from Ballard, available to about 40% AMI to comply with their MFD program requirements, so it costs about $1,046 per month for 190 square feet, kitchenette, and private bathroom. Minimum wage in Seattle is slightly higher, so it's full-time. It means a minimum wage worker makes just less than 40% of Seattle's AMI, and co-living housing is about half the average Seattle rent, making it much more accessible to people making less than that AMI. Co-living housing is just an additional option for people for important people that make Seattle's economy function. So, state law. State law defines co-living housing as a residential development with sleeping units that are independently rented and lockable and provide living space, sleeping space, and resident share kitchen facilities with other sleeping units in the building. Local governments may use other terms to refer to co-living housing, including but not limited to congregate living facilities, single room occupancy, rooming house, boarding house, lodging house, and residential suites. Simply, multiple rooms where people can live, private bathrooms optional, but bathroom access is required. They have to share a kitchen, even though a private kitchenette is also optional. They can have common areas, and we can call it what we want. So it's just, right here is a floor plan from Shorelines into Urban Lofts down the road. It's just those couple key elements that distinguish it from other types of housing. So put more in a graph or chart form, a sleeping unit is about 70 square feet compared to a traditional dwelling unit is 190 square feet per the state law. And the dwelling units have in-unit kitchens and bathrooms where sleeping units can have either, but they cannot have both. And sleeping units, when we're talking about co-living housing, must have access to that shared kitchen. It's basically the main element is that shared kitchen, and it's similar to, for a formalized way to rent a room with a private bathroom in a large home. So what are some of the benefits? Non-subsidized affordable rentals at market rate, which is 50% to AMI traditionally or normally. Private alternatives to roommates, it reduces sprawl, increases affordable housing options, it builds community and reduces loneliness. But why is it important? We have to implement the state requirement. It offers another housing option to meet the 1.1 million needed homes over the next 20 years. It'll take some pressure off of publicly subsidized affordable housing and provides another option for people of varying incomes. State requirements. It's House Bill 1998 provides some standards for unit size, parking, density fees, ground floor commercial, and some conversion project regulations. And we have to adopt our regulations by December 31st, or the state rules will preempt anything that conflicts. So highlighting some of the more important items in that state law is we have to allow co-living housing anywhere that we allow 6+ multifamily units. So it's everywhere but the NR3 zone, because the NR3 does not allow for multifamily units. We have to review the codes for overlapping names and uses. We'll have to count density for the sleeping units as 0.25 dwellings. We can regulate co-living the housing the same as multifamily apartments, or we can make it less stringent. We have to allow for conversions of commercial structures to co-living, and we can require ground floor commercial if the city defines a major pedestrian corridor. So some of the aspects we're going to be asking for direction tonight will be, do we want to require ground floor commercial for co-living housing? The city made a considerable effort with Ordinance 1000 regarding the ground floor commercial requirements. And do we want to maintain the same requirements for co-living housing as other types of apartments, or do we want to lower some of those requirements? So ground floor commercial, when we're converting existing buildings, the law says that cities must allow a property owner to add co-living housing anywhere in a converted building unless the city requires ground floor commercial. We do require ground floor commercial for multifamily developments in specific zones. So for example, if cities want to require buildings converting co-living housing to provide ground floor commercial, which is the same as we do for apartments, we can't unless we define a major pedestrian corridor. And if we don't require ground floor commercial, then co-living units can be on the ground floor. So one of the questions is, does Shoreline want to require ground floor commercial on co-living housing the same as apartment buildings? And this is regarding for conversions. Next is we have commercial adaptive reuse, or similar to conversion of existing buildings. Shoreline has to treat any buildings converting to co-living housing the same as it would a conversion to any other type of housing. The city can optionally reduce their requirements for co-living housing. So Shoreline reduces the requirements for conversions to some desirable commercial uses, but we don't have any reductions for any residential uses. So do we want to add co-living housing to the list of exemptions to make it less stringent, or do we want to keep it the same as other residential uses? So for example, if an existing commercial building converted to a restaurant, it could be exempt from the 50% site improvement threshold where they would have to come up to the existing code. No residential uses are on the list of exemptions, so if the cost of conversion exceeds 50% of the assessed property value, the entire property will need to come up to those current standards. It's important to note that if we require ground floor commercial for these conversions, it may make the cost of a construction exceed that 50% threshold. So, in summary, how does the commission want to regulate conversions of buildings to co-living housing? Does the commission want to exempt co-living housing conversions from the ground floor commercial requirements? And does the commission have any other specific input or considerations that they would like staff to add into the code update to, or into the code update related to the co-living housing at this time?
That was my cue. Well done. And that was a lot of information very quickly. So I think it may be helpful, for me at least, looking to my colleagues, to go back and walk through these one at a time.
Yeah.
To sort of ask clarifying questions. I personally am trying to wrap my head around a little bit of it, the technical pieces. So if you could go back to the first commercial conversion. Are there questions? While I rip my head around them.
I have a question. When we look at the zones, specifically NR2 is in there, but not every lot, if I'm remembering correctly, not every lot within NR2 is six units. So are we going to have, is it that same kind of map where we have the bubble within the walkable distance of the bus station that, like, that's also applied? So are we?
Right. It will likely be an allowed use in the zone with some caveats of you need to have a lot of sufficient size to meet that requirement.
Okay. So I guess practically then, how does, if one unit is half, or sorry, one sleeping
quarter.
Unit is a quarter, so four units equal, so if, in theory, if you're allowed six, is that, it's 24?
It's 24, yes.
You did math on the spot, well done.
That's a lot of fractions, okay.
But you would have to be a lot large enough to get six typical dwelling units.
For sure.
So it's sort of density math twice, which I don't love, but
like maybe the next time we can have a because I'm confused because with the six, it's still because we lowered the equation. It's like 1 to 1,200 square feet for the four unit ones, and it's like 1 to whatever that, I can't do that math. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious as how it's going to play out, and it's too many fractions for me to.
We're going to have to bring back
theory,
the Starbucks.
I think what I'm getting is like,
yeah.
We in theory allow six units within a traditional 7,200 square foot lot. So
correct.
That plays out. Obviously, you couldn't fit 24 bedrooms on that in the same way. So.
Yes, or importantly, as with any of the lots, even if the density mathematically is there,
yeah.
There's still the height limits and the lot coverage, all of that stuff still applies. Same with co-living housing.
I think as we move through this, it would be helpful to separate talking about the sort of residential zones and the commercial zones, because I think that's where I started to get confused. So.
I agree.
Because we talked a lot about conversion. And so conversion of existing, so if we go to the next one, which is conversion of existing buildings, conversion of a single family house would be different than conversion of a former motel.
Correct. This is conversions of commercial properties already, not conversions of existing houses.
Okay.
Traditionally, the city does not regulate if a private property owner rents out a room.
Okay.
So actually, procedurally, how does that work then? Is this different than renting out your room? Because in my mind, this becomes a regulated type of housing, which in theory there's, I don't remember, maybe there's a building code because it's not a dwelling unit, so it's slightly different. But it's a regulated, whereas like renting out a room in your house is not regulated. So how does that work from a policy perspective?
I think typically the housing products that are coming to market in Shoreline for like a new build, if it's something like a co-living, it's likely to look more like a multifamily building. That's where the market's generally been. And if it's just having multiple roommates in a house, I think we're going to just let that be. You can have multiple roommates in a house. And I don't know that the city's, that's like a policy question in front of us of getting into that game of regulating those types of rentals.
So to maybe button up that piece, in the NR 1 and 2 zones, it would be allowed, but we wouldn't really get into it
I imagine we'd see a larger assemblage of property before that happens.
Okay, so it would start to look like
multifamily. Just with the other development standards, I think, that would be...
I guess I'm asking the question. I'm using myself as a specific example. I live next to a 9-bedroom house.
Right.
So, but in theory, that's potentially 9 people with individual leases if you turned it into a business, which is essentially what we're talking about here, which is different than 9 roommates in some ways, because those are like, that'd be a collective lease as opposed to an independent lease. So it is different, I guess I'm confused how we're going to regulate it in one zone, but not the other, when we do have examples of homes that are gigantic, that in some ways could resemble a newer multifamily that we get, like a townhome or something like that.
I like that example because I'm wrapping my head around the word building. So the 9-bedroom house, we would not expect them to have commercial at the bottom, on the ground floor. That would be kind of silly. But if we had the motel or something in a commercial area, then that to me is a whole different kind of can of worms, right? And so... Yes?
Yes.
No? Okay. Yeah. I was trying to read that facial expression. And so if that's the case, is there gray area in between or not?
So where we require ground floor commercial, when we did that ordinance, it is in specific zones, and they look to be more commercial in nature. I want to make sure I'm reading it correctly. I'm seeing neighborhood business, community business, mixed business, town center 1, 2, and 3, and MUR 70. So are more commercial zones, right? Mm-hmm. We're not talking about, and I think we discussed this when we talked about small multifamily in, let's say, neighborhood residential 1 or 2. We said, do we want to require them to do ground floor commercial? Is that appropriate? And we said, no, we backed off of that. So the area of effect of requiring ground floor commercial is really in those more commercial zones.
Is there a size that triggers ground floor? Because if you had like a 2-story co-living building, does half of your building now have to be ground floor commercial?
I don't believe the regulation gets into number of stories or building size.
Yeah, I believe it's just when you have that use in that zone, it meets that criteria, you're subject to those additional index criteria, which would make it more beneficial to people building up to the max height limit that we've seen rather than trying to build some lower density developments.
So essentially what's on the slide in front of us, just to sort of back it up, commercial zones, the ones that we just talked about, if we leave the ground floor piece out of it altogether, the city is allowing somebody to make this, convert that building into co-living housing. The extra word in there is going to throw me off. Unless... it's in one of these places. And so the question before us is, should we be doing the thing to require ground floor commercial for these conversions?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Of an existing commercial building.
Correct.
Not a multifamily building.
But potentially a mixed use building.
Yes.
So that commercial portion of a multifamily.
How did you sign Kevin up for talking to us about housing?
It was the easiest option.
Oh, well, it's not, yeah. Okay.
Do we have a sense, and I'm sure the answer is no when I ask this question, but we don't have that many commercial buildings in the city. And like some of the ones I'm thinking of are like that hotel. And then like, do we know what kind of stock we might have to better evaluate this question? Because I'm picturing we have a lot of car dealerships and big box stores, and then we have a lot of little things. And so it's hard to from like a highest and best use, I don't think that a junky hotel probably should be turned into like, but like, then also you couldn't put in ground floor commercial because there was only the ground floor, at least in that example. So like, do we know what we have, or like, are there parameters we can place, better parameters we could place on it? So like, for the type of building that where we'd want that to be the case, just because we don't have a lot of multi-story existing commercial buildings either.
And if I can add on to that from a, I'm just thinking about from a development pro forma perspective, that hotel is going to be demolished and redeveloped. Is that a, I mean, generally, because of highest, like, because that land can go so high, it can be so much more profitable.
I think that goes into the next question, if we require site improvements or not.
So complicated, Chris.
Yeah, if I may, I think you guys are kind of spot on, at least from my perspective. The existing building stock within Shoreline probably isn't super conducive to conversions. I think it'd be pretty rare to see something convert to co-living housing. It'd be interesting if there's any regional examples where there was a conversion other than a hotel or a motel, because I think that's kind of the typical, just because there's probably minimal amount of work you need to do to modify the building to make it conducive for this form of housing.
Unless it's temporary, in the sense of a motel would not be hard to convert to this if they wanted to convert it to a more sustainable permanent leasing situation on a while they wait for future development.
And then I would also add, we have a fair amount of administrative flexibility through our administrative design review process where we can grant departures and things, including from ground floor commercial. And so just to keep that in mind too, there's always, and we can make sure that we, if you wanted to craft in that discretion into the draft code, that, you know, there's some relief valve. So if you wanted to mandate ground floor commercial on a conversion, we could still have that, the ability to grant a departure, kind of look at the individual merits of that on a case-by-case basis.
Just a quick question. Is there a possibility for those self-storage buildings to convert into the type of co-living space?
They would still have to have a window and egress access from a building code perspective.
And insulation.
And all the other things that Chris knows about, but yes. I know they need a window. And a closet.
Well, there are many fake windows.
Yeah. I think they have to have an actual window to get out in a fire.
But yes, the regulations around converting a commercial building into some sort of residence, it does need to meet the building code so that it meets the habitable requirements. So I don't know enough about storage units to know, could it happen? My guess is yes, if it's not too big of a lift for them right. to make the conversion, but if it's very complicated or costly, probably not.
I'm going to start with this thought. It makes sense to me to require ground floor commercial when these look like apartment buildings or mixed use buildings. Like, I think we did a lot of, from my perspective, we did a lot of work on that code. And if this is, you know, the buildings that you showed, which were, they looked from the outside like a mixed-use building, it would make sense to have that same thing happen. I can't wrap my head around this one. So I wanted to start with general.
I'm in agreement. I think in the zones that we're talking about, these kind of buildings, I mean, that's why we did this code to begin with, because we wanted that kind of feel or living in the city. So I think it makes sense to require ground floor commercial and conversions of existing buildings in those particular zones.
In conversions?
In conversions.
I agree. I love ground floor commercial, but I wonder, does it matter how big the building is? So if you have that two-story building, does that mean that they only have one floor that they would be able to have as a co-living housing, and so the bottom floor would be the commercial? Or is it, as long as it's, you know, a certain amount of square feet? Trying to, like, think of all the different scenarios of, you can't expect people to have more than half of your total square feet to be commercial.
Is this where Andrew's comment about departures, is that where your comment about departures comes in?
Right, yeah. So even under our existing code, we can grant departures on the ground floor commercial requirements. And so if there was a scenario where there was a conversion and someone was requesting a departure, we could look at that. Not saying it's a sure thing, but we could look at the merits of that departure request, yeah.
And that flexibility still meets the state law standards? Because I feel like I remember you saying that it kind of needs to be kind of the same kind of in the zone. So if it's within the same zone, but it's a smaller building and we're saying, oh, well, administratively we could say no, is that in violation of the Senate bill?
So the state bill requires that we cannot treat co-living housing any more stringently than multifamily housing. So it'd be the same if a multifamily house were to convert a two-story building, they might have to come up with the ground floor commercial requirement. What we're looking at tonight would be if we wanted to make it less stringent for co-living specifically. So do we want co-living explicitly sort of exempted from that requirement rather than to comply with the same as multifamily would?
Okay, thank you.
I think I'm with Leslie and Colt. I think we should just have it. It creates what we want. If it looks, you know, looks like what we want it to look like. So actually, I'm sorry. This is just for conversion. So are we saying that for a new building, it's already
required? Or is that the required? Next slide and we did them backwards?
That's our plan for the new building.
Okay.
Treat them the same.
Yeah. Okay. I still think within the context of conversions, if we have been out, I'd rather just leave it in. Just from like a worst case scenario, you know, sometimes I wouldn't want something to come in and it has to be an administrative thing to take it away, but like where we find we can't take it away and it's actually a conversion of something we don't want. At least this gives us some surety that at least we can grant the exemption rather than trying to find a way to not permit something like a bad case. Not a surprise that's allowed outright that we don't like.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yes, that.
I agree. And I actually want to take us back on to that. I hung on that quarter, like the calculation. How did that 0.25 of dwelling unit cannot count greater than quarter of dwelling unit for counting density? So can you explain that one more time?
Yeah, so a sleeping unit is about 70 square feet while a dwelling unit is about 190. So when the state law came out, they said when you're counting these sleeping units, they cannot count more than one quarter of a dwelling unit. So simply it's like a multiplier of four every time you're doing co-living housing. Four sleeping units equals one apartment when it counts towards density.
And it's a legislative requirement, so that's not an area where we have a choice to make.
Do we only have unit counts in the residential, in our zones? Or are they in the, like, unit limits?
We have them in the MUR as well.
Minimums.
Minimums?
Not maximums.
Let me check. You always look at the
Yeah,
code.
I know.
Just make it up.
So I think if four units were allowed, then 16 sleeping rooms would be allowed.
So here, the max density.
But the likelihood of that is low considering the space requirements in the NR zones.
The space will need a lot more because it's 190 minimum. I'm sorry,
if you
70.
If you multiply 70 times 16,
yeah,
which I'm
that
certainly
will be
not
a lot.
Do from the dais, It's a big house.
Right. Thank you.
I think.
Sort of.
If math works the way I... This is not the way things should be. I need a calculator in Starbursts.
And there are not unit caps in our MUR or our commercial zones. Okay. There are perhaps minimum densities in those station areas, but the code is silent on density in commercial areas, so if we did get a co-living housing, like we have just down the road, it's zoned MB, so our code is silent on what density is, but it talks about height limits and it had parking at the time, so those sorts of things still apply.
So on minimums, it would apply in the same way? If the minimum unit is 100, we now have 400 sleeping unit minimums?
But what if it's missed?
But what if... Sorry, Elise.
We can run those numbers and get back to you.
Just want to flag that one.
Well, I think there's a possibility that using that divided by 70 as the allowable floor square footage divided by 70, that will become minimum, maximum?
The code is regulating by quarter dwelling unit.
Right, that's right.
So it would have to be that math. So that would be one of the things you all would be looking at as you scrub the code of like places where it gets a little wild.
Is there a way, does the state law allow us to place a maximum on a certain, and I know we have to change this for multifamily, traditional multifamily apartments, or is there a way where we can say there's a maximum number of a certain type of unit? I don't, or like, how can we look at the Kirkland one? Because there was 200 of these and 50 regular. Like, how did they determine that mix?
Mm. So it's a minimum, not a maximum, though.
Yeah. Or no, I was thinking there's a max, like a max, is there a maximum of 100 of them allowed in one building?
No. Or,
I mean, because also, I mean, if not, the state law is obviously is one thing. If you sit at the city council meetings, they are in a request for 3-bedroom units. So in some ways, this is completely counter to a different kind of community growth goal. Mm-hmm. So like, is there a way to cap it not just here, but actually look at buildings and say it's a certain number of units?
Unit
you can't
mix.
Pass it. Yeah.
I think that there's not a way to...
Without violating state law.
...to cap or treat co-living housing any differently than multifamily housing. But I think it's also important to keep in mind that the 70-square-foot minimum and the unit counts, there are other factors at play, such as bathroom access, and they all have to share kitchen. So how many people could you comfortably share a kitchen with? We could play with those numbers there and try to figure out something that way. That way you don't have 90 units in one kitchen and one bathroom.
Mm-hmm. The state law doesn't regulate a ratio of kitchens, too.
It does not.
Interesting.
But we are allowed to.
Hmm. Provided it is not more strict than for a multifamily dwelling unit, which is typically one kitchen per unit. So if we have something less than that, I think we are safe.
Yes. So one kitchen per unit, 4 rooms make up one unit, 4 rooms
per
kitchen,
is
the dwelling
is
conversion
the
math?
Ratio? Yeah.
I would advise that we are, some of this will be driven by the market. And if we need to, we put something in place as an absolute sort of outlier protection. I personally would not want to get into sort of set, it sort of feels like parking minimums, like we're setting these based on no data sort of pieces. So I might caution against that. One of the other ways in which I have seen co-living housing work is where a family will rent an entire floor and use it as intergenerational living, which is a very cool thing. And I'm not saying that that will happen a lot, but it's a really interesting opportunity in the sense that I was part of an issue where a family spread across multiple housing units were displaced And so this was the solution for them. It was on a temporary basis, but it was sort of the best way to replicate their intergenerational living. So there's also that possibility to just sort of think about this might be used in a lot of different ways as opposed to just the way that we would think of, you know, one person per room, sort of stranger's roommate. But more to come with math is what I hear.
Yes, we can bring back that.
Very excited about that. Since we're talking about ground floor commercial, can we clarify the last bullet on this slide?
Yes. So major pedestrian corridor would be defined because the city's, the way the rule is written, it's written on like a triple negative where it's cities cannot prohibit a conversion of a commercial building for the placement of dwelling units anywhere unless the city requires ground floor commercial along a major pedestrian corridor as defined by the city. So if we were to have a ground floor commercial requirement, we would have to define what we consider a major pedestrian corridor and where we require that ground floor commercial.
Which we would just do with the way we've already defined ground floor commercial?
I would
was
love
our
to hope so, yes. Make a very circular definition that it's wherever we want it.
Any opposition to that, y'all? We did that work already.
Correct.
Excellent.
So I apologize if this question was already answered, but have we looked into what other people consider the right, the amount of square footage for the living space, the communal living space or kitchen for, I mean, is there best practices somewhere so that if you have four units, then the kitchen, the shared living space should be 800 square feet or something?
Not that was in the state guidance. The only codes that were offered up as examples was Seattle's, and they are silent on that. We also wouldn't be able to impose a kitchen size requirement to co-living since we don't require it for multifamily. However, I think the building code has minimum size requirements and room dimensions, which is where we get the 190 square feet and that 70 square feet from. I think a lot of that would be driven by market demand of not making something too cramped, but the state law is silent.
Yeah, at the end of the day, someone needs, even if they're inexpensive, somebody needs to actually agree to rent to them.
I actually want to bring us to slightly like looking from outside. So now if we convert these commercial buildings into more like a dwelling unit, does that affect any of the open space requirement, the counting of that? I am just having a worry, like say it's very popular and all of a sudden like shoreline having plenty of these type of conversion. And so we actually having more of these living units and these people are in a shared situation. But so the open space actually became relatively more important. So what will come to support if say we have more rapid conversion or development toward this type of housing possibility?
So we're only starting to get into some of those requirements where we are looking at our code and trying to figure out how that would work. I believe that the commercial multifamily section talks about 800 square feet minimum or 50 square feet per residential unit. And looking at that, we could change that residential unit to just be to unit. We don't have residential unit defined anywhere in code, but we could look at that as, does it mean living unit, rentable space, to keep the ratios the same per person, or we can look at it similar to one quarter dwelling per living unit, or one quarter living unit per dwelling. One dwelling equals 0.25 living units, sleeping units.
You're doing great. I think it'd be good to have a chart that describes the different units and what to have accounts for.
I think our proposal was to have the open space requirements be the same for a multifamily and for a co-living housing, because again, they can be the same, but not more restrictive. And yes, when you're in a shared environment, perhaps that communal space become outside of your private room becomes more important. So we cannot require higher ratios, but we can require the same as for multifamily. When it comes to conversions, I'll have to read back through the bill just to make absolutely certain that there's no prohibition on ratios around open space when you're doing a conversion, but just doing a quick, you know, keyword search, I didn't see anything. But we'll want to confirm that, because yes, you can potentially start to cannibalize the open space and start converting it to private living space, and wanting to make sure that that's what we're intending, or if we specifically don't want it, to make sure there's protections in place.
Are there places where you all are thinking that it might benefit to be less stringent with this housing type, since that's something that we can do? Places where our multifamily rules may just get in the way of this type of housing. That can just stay on the parking lot. That's just really just as we're talking about sort of, I'm just like, are there things that we need to think about to make sure that that if co-living housing is at a disadvantage with certain parts of our code, then it won't show up in certain parts of our zone. Mm-hmm. Like if we kept a minimum, I don't know if there's a minimum unit count of 100, but if we kept a minimum unit count of 400, that seems, that just on its face seems extreme to me, which would really mean we would be directing those types of developments not in that zone. Mm-hmm. So that's just, as y'all are sort of scrubbing the code to think about how this gets implemented, that's one that I might keep in mind. From my perspective, this is multifamily housing. It doesn't look, feel, or act differently. I am wildly supportive and think it's a really important choice option for folks to have. I also think that it's an important affordability strategy and sort of both aging up and aging down sort of strategy. So the more we can do, the better, but without sort of shifting the sort of focus of our development to be preferential one way or the other.
I think the primary way I was looking at it would be through the exemption of commercial adaptive reuse. When we're looking at conversions of existing buildings, some of these building stocks could be older and require a lot more investment, and their valuations might be lower. Having a potential exemption to reduce that requirement so it might be exempt from some of those site design standards is where I had preliminarily identified, trying to keep it in line with the multifamily requirements that were put in place by the commission and council not that long ago, the ground floor commercial requirements, and the kind of construction we have been seeing as it does look like multifamily housing. So that was the one area I identified as, do we want to create an exemption that does not exist for any other residential uses for co-living?
On commercial conversions.
Correct.
This is where I go back to the comments about understanding the sort of on, like, I would hate for us to spend a ton of time on this and getting it just right if the opportunities are two. And I don't know what the, and, you know, over time the opportunities will probably be more than two, but that's sort of where I'm at, is like thinking through what are some examples that we're talking about here would be helpful on these conversion ones, maybe.
Okay.
Sorry.
I can't hear.
Yeah, how many buildings in Shoreline are we talking about that would be converted? you know, we talking?
That wouldn't be wild. I mean, I wouldn't want you all to have to do that count, but sort of that wouldn't be wildly under. If highest and best use is a 70-foot apartment building and it's a single-story hut, that's going to be demoed.
Right.
Right. So it's sort of like that. That's not what we're talking about. So this is sort of a preservation strategy. And I'm not sure what I don't have a sense in my head of the types of opportunities for preservation in our commercial zones. If that's helpful.
Yeah, I agree with you. But how many buildings do we think are in Shoreline that might be converted? Versus demoed.
And would they already be converted for multifamily? So, like, this is where we're treating, like, we're thinking about this separately from multifamily?
Correct. So if you're converting, for example, a motel to co-living, there's no exemptions for multifamily. If you were to convert to multifamily, it would just, you'd have to come up with the site improvements if you hit the 50% threshold. Which in certain zones require ground floor commercial and other requirements for index criteria. If we were to convert to co-living, we wouldn't require necessarily ground floor commercial, or we wouldn't necessarily require the 50% threshold. We'd allow it to be reused and not have to come up with those site improvement thresholds.
Oh, I thought you were going to say something. You're just tapping. Thinking about talking.
So I'm sorry, but remind, and you've said it probably three times, but just ask a different, if we convert one of those commercial things to like a restaurant, we don't require, we don't follow the substantial improvement 50% threshold.
Right. Mm-hmm. If it was existing commercial and we want to change it to another commercial, so let's say it was a bank building and you want to turn it into a brew pub, great. Yeah. Please proceed. Is how the commercial adaptive reuse code is written. But if it was, a bank and trying to turn it to co-living housing or turn it into an apartment building, mm-hmm. what are we looking at? We don't have any outs, right, in terms of needing to come up to site design standards.
I guess I'm torn on it from that perspective. Because it puts it at odds with we want housing, but we also want potential commercial activities. And some of those smaller, just thinking of a smaller building, like if it sits there long enough, like at some point a restaurant can be there and potentially be there longer than a higher and best use apartment. Like I could see it turning into a co-living. I'd like a new name too. co-living, but I could see that to your point, Leslie, it's probably like a temporary thing, but if it turns into like a longer business establishment, it may not be like a temporary thing. Thinking of like, if you think some of the abandoned buildings now on Fernlands, like that bank is probably better suited as a commercial thing than housing, but that's maybe just my opinion.
You just triggered my sadness over Baskin Robbins going out of business the minute I moved down the street. It's all fine. My gut, nobody's waiting for me to talk. My gut is that I do feel like this does feel like a place where if we're specifically talking about a motel type structure,
okay.
Converting to allowing that sort of, it's no longer financially feasible to really be a motel, allowing that to become co-living housing. Again, we need a new name. That seems right. To me, that could activate that space in a way that is positive. That motel is not going to become, probably not going to become a restaurant, right? Just from a, so that's where this makes a ton of sense to me is in that specific sort of building type or a small, you know, some sort of small format that also we may want to convert because it is an existing sort of small footprint character type situation. I do like the idea of an exemption.
I agree. I like the exemption, just lowering the barrier in this specific instance to allow the co-living kind of a foothold if to reuse some of those buildings. Yeah.
And it sounds a pretty targeted exemption. We're talking of motel, hotel, sort of like, sort of residential-y, changing into co-living and feeling comfortable with that versus, let's say, a restaurant changing into co-living. Am I following that?
I think I've only made that point because that's what feels practical.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that I would limit it.
I don't think I'd put it in the code because I just don't think anybody's going to change a restaurant into co-living.
Gotcha.
There's that piece.
But
if they want to, I'm fine with that.
Or an abandoned bank building that's maybe obsolete from a commercial perspective, turning it into, I mean, I think that's the whole point of adaptive reuse, right, is the sort of obsolete type buildings. If they're not rented, they're not functional from a commercial perspective. So how can we make them activated and turn them into housing? Chris might not agree.
I just think at some point it's counter to a lot of our other goals about getting commercial spaces, and commercial spaces in brand new buildings that we keep building here are exponentially more expensive from a rent and an operational standpoint than an existing old building, especially if we exempt a substantial improvement aspect of the code. And we have enough of them that are kind of mid to not used that I think there's at some point there's a, especially Bartels going out of business all the time, there's some pressure to there's a pressure on the rent and the cost of that land that it may become more affordable. And if it's going to become more affordable and it just becomes housing, then we've taken away an opportunity for one of the things that we say we want. I don't think it's going to happen. I think people are just going to build 3 or 4-story things that meet the single stair code and do it. But from a worst case scenario, you know, it's like down the street in Richmond Beach Road where they're tearing down a shopping center to build a retirement community that has nothing. So we've already proactively written a code to ensure that things that we want aren't going away. And so that I think that's my tension with providing like an exemption for something like that, is I just don't know if that's going to get us what we want.
More comfortable if it's narrow?
Yeah.
Okay. Chris says narrow. Anyone else?
That makes me wonder, angry, but you know, once again, going back to size, you know, if you're going to have X number more people, does that mean that we should have more commercial? So if you're going to have co-living that has, I don't know, 15 people, that's very different than if you have co-living that has now 40 people, because now we need more infrastructure for those people. So I would think it should have to do with size. Okay. Because you have to, if you're going to have all these extra people, you're going to need to have extra infrastructure for them to go shopping and everything else. Otherwise, we're going to have a little bit of a problem. So that's kind of how I was wrapping my head around, you know, if you have 2 stories, one story is commercial, that's just wrong. But if you have 40 people on this site, then I think you need to have commercial on the ground floor to accommodate them and others. Does that make sense?
I agree, Julie. I think that's a great point, because living in small spaces, we need those third places to gather and also the walkable markets and that sort of thing. So thank you. And also, Colt, thank you for making me laugh out loud with my cat on the restaurant conversion.
And Lauren, thank you for just speaking up. I'm sorry if I just realized that I didn't see you a minute ago.
That's okay. I was able to sneak right in.
You did. Excellent. That's how it works.
Actually, I'm going to change my answer. I'm okay with it. Sorry, because I'm frankly worried. I'm worried about the size. We've gone through so much effort to simplify the code. And if we do a size, applying a size to it requires we understand what housing stock is. And I don't think we can do I don't think we can do a study of every property within the city limits by December that says, like, these are the commercial properties that could. And so then we're arbitrarily, to your point, Leslie, we're arbitrarily picking a size at which it becomes there. We've already said that we want them to put the ground floor commercial in, so and we have the pathway out. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to change my answer. I'm fine with just an exemption.
See, if we just spin around here long enough, eventually we agree.
Mostly because I have to read code all the time and I'm tired of having to like ascertain like the right number because it's always slightly off, and then you're still going to call our friend Andrew for
and
an
size
exemption.
Means more math.
Thank you for letting me change my mind.
At least
so
you don't
recap,
look like you're clear.
I just want to make sure that we understand. On this commercial adaptive reuse, potentially finding an exemption for co-living housing as sort of the list of uses that, hey, if you're going to convert a building that was previously commercial into this thing, we're not going to make you do all the big site improvements. Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
You're doing great. Welcome.
Thanks.
Sorry, that's bringing me back to some painful memories about the ADU counts or not counts.
Yeah, I know. It's, we've been through it all, which is why it's great.
Yes, the state to write laws differently so we don't have to hurt our heads.
Silly state. Were there additional slides with additional questions on them?
Do you have any other specific input or considerations that you would like staff to add into the code or update related to co-living housing at this time?
I guess I'm curious with number three, going back to the NR2, NR1 zones where it is a single family home, potentially conversion, so when we look at that, how do we differentiate it? I'm thinking of large homes that do have a lot of people, because when we create, if I'm remembering, three units on a lot, that comes with certain requirements for like fire sprinklers and things like that. Mm-hmm. But in some ways, we're allowing just the same number of development but in a different configuration. And I know some of that is not entirely the building code, it's an engineering manual kind of thing, but I'm just worried about the tension of those two things, and are we inadvertently not getting some of the things that we want, or just we have that one-off zone that's very different than the rest of them.
Are you asking how the unit count in one and the unit count in the other interact with like the
yes.
sprinkler code?
Well, there's requirements, like a lot of this overlaps with creating 2, 3, 4 units, but within conversion, I don't remember the answer if you converted one unit to three on a residential lot, if we required you to do that upgrade, and if we did, should we find a different way to evaluate these commensurate with that?
Specifically to fire sprinklers?
I'm just remembering that if you look at going from one house per lot to four houses per lot, that we do have requirements for other things.
We do, and importantly with the middle housing code, those requirements could not be more stringent than they were
yeah.
for a detached residence. So it's a very similar case here of...
Some of those are a building code thing too,
yeah.
though, like number of units. So I guess I'm just curious, like this in some ways feels like that, and it would be a building code trigger, so I'm just...
And I think we'd need to speak with our partners in building to understand some of those
yeah.
nuances.
So it's not that it's just an overlap, but it's not a
Is
land
the
use overlap.
Building code ready for this 0.25 to 1 unit situation?
The building code already defines sleeping unit. There's definitions for efficiency units as well. I don't know how they're set up in regards to co-living conversions of NR residences to co-living, but we can talk with our partners over there.
I was mostly just concerned about the math. I don't need to follow up on
that
question.
I think they are silent on the density. But
they have a definition for sleeping rooms. That's
yeah.
that's really what I was thinking of. Other considerations, y'all?
I think it's been said before, but I do think that, especially in the larger co-living buildings, that we need to have some sort of consideration for open spaces, shared open spaces and things like that, because, you know, 70 square feet is tiny and we don't have a lot of third places around here. So that's something that should be at least looked at, I think. I know that there's other, you know, it can't be too different from what we have in our other types of multifamily housing, but we should look into that, I think.
Can I clarify? Do you mean indoor common space or outdoor open space?
Both.
Okay.
Honestly, yeah. I think more, probably more so in indoor space, but both would probably be worth looking at.
I would agree with that.
Devil's advocate, do we have common area space requirements in multifamily currently?
We do have open space requirements in 2050-240 for 800 square feet per development or 50 square feet per residential unit.
But we'll look into that about, is that outside, is that inside, can it be blended, is that an area that our code maybe needs some attention, again, to make sure that it's either treated the same as multifamily or is less stringent than our multifamily standards. Those are our options.
I think from my perspective, again, just to state it as part of this question, this is multifamily. I don't see a reason for us to think about it differently, just to make sure that we're not getting in the way of it being produced. Anything else? All right, and besides starbursts and diagrams, is there anything else you all need from us on this?
No, I can go over the proposed schedule unless there's anything more you'd like to discuss.
That'd be great.
So today you've been introduced to regulatory requirements in the GMA are incorporating co-living housing to our city regulations. September 18th, we'll start discussing the overall development code amendments, and we'll include some of the responses from tonight. And to the co-living housing will be batched into or rolled into that batch. October 16th is the planned public hearing and the recommendation on all those development code amendments. And between October and December is council.
Excellent. We will see you again in a month and a half, I think, if that's how time works. All right, moving on, y'all. I'm just going to combine them. Do we have any unfinished new business or reports and announcements? Oh, Andrew, which one? Sorry, I messed it up.
No, that's quite all right. And I lost my screen.
Oh, sorry.
Regardless, yeah. So let's see, just a couple of quick updates and some information. So I know I included in the packet that went out with you last week and the updates that the council was considering the proposed parking amendments recommendation that you all passed through a little bit ago. So that was on Monday evening, and it's scheduled for the follow-up or action is scheduled for next Monday, so in just a few days. So they'll be taking proposed action on Monday night on your recommendation to eliminate the parking minimums, and that's the bike parking code updates as well. And then I wanted to just highlight again, this was in the information that went out to you, but we have open right now the application for the Tree Code Update Advisory Committee, I think is what we're calling it. So if you know of anyone that might be interested in applying, you can send them the link. If you can't find it, send it my, or let one of us know and we can make sure we get it to you. But that committee will be really important to be forming a recommendation on the Tree Code Update before it comes to you for further deliberation and then your recommendation. So we're building in this additional step in our process just to be more inclusive, getting kind of a broader spectrum of involvement and different viewpoints before we have a recommendation for the commission to consider. So wanted to highlight that too in case you all know of anyone and can help just spread the word.
Great, thank you. All right, and our agenda for our next meeting.
Yeah, next meeting, August 21st. So yeah, we have the docket for the 2025 comprehensive plan amendments coming your way. We have two items on this year's docket, one related to changes on the countywide center's boundaries, and the other related, it's kind of a cleanup amendment on the level of traffic stress table that's in the comp plan, if you remember. So that will be coming for discussion on August 21st.
Excellent. Anything else for the good of the order? No. Thank you very much. I feel like you've been initiated to this group.
Yeah.
And we are adjourned.